Okay, folks, welcome to Life on Planet Porkin. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Myself and, of course, the irrepressible Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, rock chick writer extraordinaire. And I have to say, Leslie Ann, as we're heading towards Christmas now, this is our last but two of podcasts until we go away for Christmas. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, this year has just whizzed by, hasn't it? Been thrilling.
Yeah.
I mean, for all kinds of ups and down reasons. But
yeah,
the most momentous year in which we could have launched our podcast, I think.
I totally agree. And, you know, I've been literally dragged screaming into the electronic age because I never did things outside of studios because I couldn't understand them. But we've just had to learn how to do these things, and we've had to learn how to adapt. And, you know, I'm delighted that we've been able to keep going, even though we can't physically get into a studio together. But there we go. Now, talking about all that, Miss Jones, right? I have now decided, after lots of very deep thought, that I am going to abandon any plans to go and join my family for Christmas. I would normally have jumped in the old Merc and shot down the M3 to Bournemouth and spent 3 days there with the family. However, I'll be working in and out of London next week, all week, and London is now a tier 3 zone, full clamp down, ridiculously shutting all the bars. But that means that I would be in danger of, according to the experts, picking up the virus and taking it with me to a tier 2 zone on the south coast.
Well, I think it's a very sensible decision. Mm-hmm. I've seen that Age UK are saying that more than 850,000 people will be spending Christmas alone this year. Mm-hmm. And this could be a first for many people because of the COVID rules. But you're ahead of the game. You're right. And it's for the safety of people who are older than you, your elderly relatives. They are more vulnerable. But there's a big difference, you know, between being alone and lonely. And it's a great opportunity to get rid of some old habits. If you don't want turkey, for example, have a ham. If you don't want to watch television, if that's rubbish on there, have a long soak in the bath and use all your posh toiletries and things, or go for a walk and appreciate nature. I think it's one day, and I think it's a small sacrifice to make for the greater good. So I applaud you, Michael.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I mean, you talk about elderly relatives. I've got members of my family in their 70s, two brothers-in-law, OK? My little sister Jill is in her 60s, and I couldn't bear the thought of putting them in danger. But the other thing is, people are walking around on eggshells. I mean, my brother-in-law is so fastidious about the way he lives his life and all that. He actually gets the papers washed before he reads them in the morning when they've come through the letterbox. You see what I mean?
Washed? How do you wash a newspaper and then read it?
Well, you literally take it into the utility room and get a cloth and wipe the outer covers of the paper. He won't touch it until that's done, you know, with disinfectant. I mean, it's a sort of
great idea. You wipe all the ink off?
Say again?
You wipe all the ink off?
Well, you get some ink off, obviously, but I mean, he prefers that to having to touch it, you know, in its natural state, so to speak. So you can imagine the sort of atmosphere that would be around a crowded house at Christmas with people who feel like that, you know, justifiably like that. So I have decided to say to myself, I'm going to stay here. And I told the family yesterday, told my sister Jill, very supportive. She's going to have her children there, and that's the most important thing, you know, after such a terrible year. So as I'm sure you'll appreciate from your position as well. But when you say break habits of a lifetime, the first thing I did when I decided on this, I thought, well, that means really I can listen to any music I want to now on Christmas Day and Boxing Day. And that will be, of course, a range of things like the White Album and Abbey Road, which I haven't listened to in its entirety for ages, you know. And so I've bought from Currys a new CD player. That's a bit old-fashioned, really, isn't it?
Well, no, not at all. If the majority of your record collection is on CD, you need something to play them on. It's like new cars that come without CD players.
Yes.
They just have kind of ports that you can plug stuff in.
That's right, yeah.
People do still like to lug their old CDs around and play those. So I don't want a car that doesn't have a CD player.
No, I totally agree. I mean, Spotify and all this kind of thing is okay, but you know, like you say, I prefer the physical thing of getting a CD out of the plastic box and then opening the lid of the CD player and putting it on and firing it. You know, I mean, I just like that. And that's the way we are. Talking about Spotify, by the way, Miss Jones, of course, the breaking royal story is that Harry and Meghan are getting a show on Spotify for an awful lot of money. I read £16 million.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Did you read Piers's very funny send-up of that in the Mail Online? He's really got it in for those two.
No.
He calls them absurd, ultra-woke, freeloading chancers, narcissists, hypocrites, and greed merchants, which is just about the size of it, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
I mean, what have they got to tell us that we really need to hear?
Well, A, I don't know what they've got to tell us. And B, I don't think that, I think they're so out of touch with the rest of the world. Would we find anything they've got to say interesting? You know, when you and I talk, we talk about issues which are swirling around us, which are leaping off the, you know, the pages of newspapers, which are personal experiences with friends in different businesses. But they don't mix with anybody. What have they got? Literally, what have they got to talk about?
Well, they've got their celebrity mates, I suppose. People like Oprah Winfrey. And
they're not going to reveal any great, you know, world-shattering news about them. All that will be a love fest, won't it? You know,
promoting their latest kind of organic coffee or oat milk or whatever it is. But I think pass on this one. Why is Spotify paying them so much money? Who do they think is going to listen to this tripe?
Yes.
And what's the point?
I can see you've made your mind up calling it tripe already. Yeah.
Well, I heard the trailer, and I mean, the trailer was prime for sending up those couple of seconds that they played on television.
Yeah, sure. But here's another line here, look. 60s pop star Sandy Shaw led an attack by British musicians on Spotify last night over its lucrative podcast deal with Harry and Meghan. Research shows that most artists receive just £200 a year from services that stream their songs. I mean, that's so ludicrous. You know, people like Oasis only get about 200 quid a year from Spotify.
Yeah, streaming has hijacked music. And there needs to be an investigation about this, I think.
Yeah.
It'd be very interesting to see whether Harry and Meghan will feature music on their podcast. And I wonder what kind of music they favour as well.
Yeah, I don't think they will. I think if they do, does that mean then they're endorsing particular artists and all that kind of stuff? That'll start another blinking row, you know, about wokeism and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
But the bottom line point here is, who are they? What do they have to say that will change our lives in any positive way? Yeah. Now that they've decided not to be royals, what is their status in the world and what qualifies them to lecture the rest of us?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And at the same time, of course, the Daily Mail are absolutely determined to get Prince Andrew, aren't they? You know.
Oh, God, what a campaign that's been this week.
Incredible, you know, sort of 5 pages a day for 3 days. You know, he stayed at Epstein's home. This is the missing address. And he was in, I don't know. Anyway, it's all rules. Talking about pop stars, we should celebrate the birthday of Billy Gibbons. And people say, who's Billy Gibbons? And I'll say, well, remember ZZ Top and those two guys with very long beards who had guitars which actually spun on their axle and went round and came back again. I thought they were brilliant, ZZ Top. Really loved them. Did you have any dealings with them?
I interviewed them once when I was on the Mail some years ago, yeah. How old do you think Billy Gibbons is today?
Well, I think already 66, which makes him the same age as me.
Where'd you get that from?
I don't know, Miss Jones, do I? You know, I do my research and I can't get everything right all the time.
We ought to do it properly because he's actually 71.
Is he? 71, eh?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it looks
so
good.
Anyway, he's the lead vocalist, the main guitarist.
Yeah.
He's the one who's also known as the Reverend Billy F. Gibbons.
Why?
One of his monikers, I don't think he's a proper priest or anything. But
the
thing I love about that band is you've got two guys, Billy and Dusty Hill, who've got these great long beards down to their waist.
Are they brothers, even though they've got different names?
No, they're not. Because of the beards. But the guy in the band who doesn't have a beard, he's very clean shaven, who is the drummer, is called Frank Beard, which I think is hilarious.
How ridiculous. The reason I like them is because they emerged, of course, in the 80s, and so did MTV. And that's when I first worked in America. And I mean, MTV in those days wasn't available in this country. And the sheer wonder of watching these incredible videos, you know, which they spent millions on making for MTV, were fantastic. But the sexiest one ever was She's Got Legs by ZZ Top. She's got legs, da 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 da, and she knows how to use them. She's got legs. And then all it showed something was this like fantastic her. Old red car. Do you remember? Like an old Ford T model or something like that. And ground going up shots of the doors opening and all these fantastic, gorgeous looking women getting out with fantastic pairs of legs. It was the most erotic and sexiest video I've ever seen.
Very sexist, I would say. We wouldn't get past the censors nowadays, would it? But yeah. What I loved about them was that just that raw blues rock style.
Yes, I
they
agree.
Revived that whole musical genre, and it sat very well in the 80s against all that sort of bubblegum pop, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, no, I totally agree. It did, all that sort of new romance and all that sort of bollocks,
New romantics, even.
Yeah, new romantics, that's right. All that sort of dreadful rubbish. Of course, I'd be like that, wouldn't I? Now,
you would.
So what did they say to you when you interviewed them then?
I can't remember. It's back in the 80s. I mean, what do you think I am? I can remember every single dialogue from every interview.
They clearly didn't make much of an impression upon you, did they? I mean, they're very distinctive
people. Really, no. I thought they were a bit sort of musty and quaint for my taste, but then I was only a stripling.
Stripling, eh? Yes, well, I've heard you called many things, Miss Jones. Stripling is not one of them. Listen, I've got a great idea for you. Because you lead the field in writing biographies for rock stars, okay? And, of course, your current book, Who Killed John Lennon, has hit the top of the Amazon sales chart and been featured on Piers Morgan's GMB. I reckon your next book should be Who Killed Brian Jones?
Ah, well, that's an ongoing mystery, isn't it? Nobody really knows what happened there.
Exactly, that's what I mean. And with your powers of investigation, you'd get to the bottom of it, and suddenly you would reveal exactly what happened to Brian Jones. Was it the local builder who came round for his money? Brian Jones wouldn't give him, so he hit him and knocked him into the swimming pool. Did Brian Jones just fall in of his own accord after Mick Jagger and Keith Richard had visited his home, which used to be owned and occupied by the guy who wrote Pooh the Bear, wasn't it?
Winnie the Pooh, in
Winnie
fact,
the Pooh,
yes.
That's him, yeah, yeah.
It was A.A. Milne's old house, wasn't it?
That's him, yeah, absolutely. But yes, it is one of rock's great enduring mysteries, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I remember Bill Wyman, the bassist of the Stones, telling me a story about how there was a very young blonde Swedish girl staying at the house with Brian Jones, and she was underage, and the lengths they went to get her out of the house and out of the country before the police cottoned on to this. So there's a much deeper mystery to that story, which is rather unsavory in obvious ways. But you're right. It would be a good mystery to investigate.
Yeah, no, it certainly would. I mean, I've read a couple of the old Stones biographies as well. And apparently, Brian Jones was just so out of it on drugs, he couldn't even pick up a guitar, let alone play it, and couldn't remember any words or any notes or anything like that, which is a really sad demise for a bloke who people don't realise actually invented and created the Rolling Stones, didn't he?
Yeah, he founded the band. It was his band.
Yeah.
But he was distracted in lots of ways. He had, about a dozen children by different women.
Yes, I know.
And was very prolific. He started his fatherhood career very young indeed.
Yeah.
So I think he was distracted from the band. Mick and Keith, when they came on board, were much more businesslike and focused and driven. And it was obvious that they were going to take it in a different direction.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. He came from Cheltenham. I think his father was a vicar. And he used to, I read in one of the books, he used to take real joy in ringing up his mum and dad on a Friday night when he'd started his pop career in London, you know, and they were becoming famous. And just to shock his parents, because they were so matronly and his dad was a vicar, he used to tell his parents how many women he'd caught venereal disease off that week, you know, and he said, oh, I've got gonorrhea and all this sort of stuff.
Well, so you can actually count how many you get it from. That's unusual. Well, is that a scientific development?
Well, I don't know. And I'm sorry, this is a family show, obviously, but I mean, it just... I've just remembered the family show, so we should scrub that from the record, really.
Yeah, but go on then.
Just to illustrate that... Brian Jones was quite an extraordinary bloke, wasn't he? His candle burnt bright, but not for very long, yeah?
And at every single end.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I mentioned that and what gave me the spark to tell you about Brian Jones is that I've read that the Netflix, the next great smash hit, is going to be the story of the Rolling Stones Netflix version, like The Crown.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I wonder why it's taken them so long to get around to that.
But yeah, I suppose you're right.
There's a big Whitney Houston film coming as well, isn't it? Written by Anthony McCartan, who wrote Bohemian Rhapsody. So that's going to be a very accurate truth-telling exploration of Whitney's life, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. Now, what I wanted to talk to you about, Miss Jones, is your great friend, Miss Liz Jones, OK? Because I read her column every week and I think she's a sensational writer. But she's really surpassed herself this week because, you'll have read it, obviously, but going on about how in the past, you know, boyfriends have cheated on her and that sort of stuff, and how women have a propensity to want to steal other women's boyfriends, which drives her mad. Have you ever had that experience?
Yeah, I have. I think we all have. And yeah. I think...
Well, nobody's ever tried to steal my girlfriends because they knew that they'd get themselves into trouble if they did.
Well, you'd belt them one.
Oh, absolutely.
Presumably. But I think, yeah, it happens to women. And I'm always surprised by females who will do this to other females. Whatever happened to the sisterhood? You know, we all need to support each other and have each other's backs. And I think the vast majority of girls are very protective of each other. Mm-hmm. But you always get these cuckoos who come along and think that it's clever and big to have what somebody else is having.
Yeah.
And it's a very unkind thing to do. But look at the number of women who go off with other people's husbands. So,
Yes. Well, yes, absolutely. Anyway, Miss Jones, the other Miss Jones, that is Liz Jones, says at the end of her piece, talking about another woman, she obviously didn't want me hovering around. And she's talking about her sort of lifelong boyfriend, David. She obviously didn't want me hovering around David. He always leaves specks of tobacco around. And so it was hovering and hoovering. So there is always some bubble-permed harlot desperate for a man, especially over the festive period, in the background, ready to snap up your reject once you've taken your talons out. I mean, that's fighting talk, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's kind of true. I mean, look, we love Liz Jones. We love her stream of consciousness. She's eccentric. God love her. And she has no off switch. And we need her.
Yes, yes. Well, no, totally agree. Absolutely. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Miss Jones, I have already made the statement about the fact that I will be spending Christmas home alone. But as you quite rightly say, I won't actually be alone. I live on my own anyway, so I'm very used to it. And actually, funny enough, in the block I live in, there's two or three other single people who I happen to know have made the same decision as me. So we will meet, you know, at distance inside each other's apartments for a quick Christmas.
Well, you can't do that because they're not in your bubble.
Sorry?
You can't do that because they're not in your bubble.
Yes, you can. You can go to somebody else's house and have a drink if you stand 2 metres away from them, can't you?
Not if they're not in your bubble. If you're intending to see other people or if they are, you know, you don't live with those people. They're not your family.
Yeah.
So you can't be going inside each other's apartments.
I didn't know that.
You can meet outside on the terrace.
Oh, we could do that. Yeah.
Toast them over the wall, but you can't go inside. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Good thinking. Some of us have got roof gardens, so we can actually have a glass across the fence, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very high fence, but I mean, you stand on something like a ladder. or something like that.
Oh, God, don't go doing that. You'll fall over the balcony and then there'll be murders.
Yeah, you could well be right. But, I mean, just getting back to that, because we opened the podcast with it, you know, the more I look at this morning's papers, the more I think, well, how can anybody feel safe going to anybody else's house over Christmas? The fright before Christmas, says the Daily Mail. The Times is even worse. Elderly told to keep away from family at Christmas. And, of course, as you and I, you know, keep up with rolling news, the guy who's running Wales, Mark Drakeford, he's now reducing the family bubbles you've just been talking about from three families down to two. So yeah. I think there's a general malaise across the country about all this.
Yeah, and rightly so. You know, we've been told to keep away from our vulnerable elderly.
Yeah.
My mum had her first dose of the vaccine on Monday. She's 86. She did quite well, and she said she had no side effects. She gets the second dose on the 11th of January, 21 days later.
Yes.
So in the meantime, she's not protected.
Yes.
So anyone who spends time with my mother in the interim, i.e. over Christmas, is risking her life.
Okay, and you're going to be with her?
No, I'm not.
Oh, I see. Right, okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but my mother's very pragmatic about it. She sees the bigger picture. She sees the common good. And I think the elderly, those who are compos mentis enough to do so, need to be laying down the law as well to their loved ones. It's all very well people saying, oh, we can't possibly not see mother or grandma over the holidays. But yes, you can if it means risking their lives. Yeah. There's always next year.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The one thing I'm really, really angry about is the closure of the bars. You may have seen a picture that I put out earlier this week when I had lunch with a friend in London, okay?
I did.
And I took that picture not to self-promote myself, but it was a picture in a beautiful pub, the Thameside Inn, which you may or may not know, on the banks of the River Thames. No, next to the model of Sir Francis Drake's ship in the dock there. But the point is, I wanted to take that picture to illustrate how beautifully they'd done up the pub. The decorations were beautiful. There were beautiful Christmas trees all over the place, stuff hanging from the roof. They, you know, they decorated everything. And then we went there on the day before the latest close down. And I felt so sorry for them as I was leaving. They said, well, that's it now, I'm afraid, until the new year. And all those decorations, which had only been up for about 10 days, all had to be thrown away, wasted, because by the time they reopen in January, Christmas and New Year will be long gone. And I spoke to Tim Martin, who I've mentioned to you before, the man who runs Wetherspoons. He controls 870 pubs. I spoke to him last Sunday. He told me they have not had one recorded case of a COVID-19 infection in any one of his 870 pubs. I think they're one of the safest environments in this country.
It's possible, isn't it? But I mean, pubs have been under assault for quite some time. First of all, there was the smoking ban, wasn't there, that forced them to invest in outside areas. I think going to the pub is a habit which, once broken, it's quite hard to get back into, especially if there's a cheaper alternative, such as going to the supermarket and buying the booze and drinking it at home. I think we could be taken back to the days of the speakeasy during Prohibition in the US. And I think there could be a return to, well, maybe even a drink delivery service of some kind.
Yes.
But pubs have been in decline since 2002. And I'm sure that this year we'll see the largest number for years closing for good.
Oh, I'm sure you will. One of my local pubs has already closed. It's a Fuller's pub. They're a big chain, but they just came to the conclusion that it become, you know, economically unviable. So it's a great British institution. You know how much I love pubs, but I don't know what the future of that will hold. Now, I want to tell you a story, Miss Jones, which is it's a story of which I have a lot of regret about. Did you see a report this week, by any chance? Because I know you're an avid watcher of news programmes like me, that guide dogs have to be retrained once they lose their focus on their owner because they need total concentration all the time.
I didn't quite understand this report. Are they saying that they have to be retrained between owners or what?
Well, basically it was an appeal to the public to say, please don't treat a guide dog like any other dog. Please don't pet it. Please don't pat it. Please don't hug it. Please don't make it the center of attention, because that distracts from the dog's ability to do the job. And the job is that the dog has to concentrate at all times on its owner, who has, you know, visual impairment problems, so that the owner feels totally safe with the dog and is not doubting the behavioural attitude of the dog. Do you see what I mean?
Well, of course, but that bit is common sense. I mean, when would any person with a brain go up to a guide dog and make a fuss of it and pat it?
Surely we all are.
Yeah, but I think, and I wouldn't. I think we understand, right-thinking people, that that's not what a guide dog is for.
Yeah, well, people do all the time because they're lovely dogs. They're usually Labradors and or Golden Retrievers or something, you know. They look. But the terrible story I've got to tell you is that I once employed a chap at TalkSport who had visual impairment issues, okay? And he had a guide dog, and it was a beautiful Labrador. I can't remember the name of it now. I wish I could, because it was a beautiful dog. And anyway, I used to make a terrible fuss of this dog, and then I started bringing in food for the dog, okay? You know, things like little chewy bones and all that kind of stuff, right? And I knew something had gone wrong when every time I went into my office and then I went out again, I opened the door and the dog was lying in front of the office with its paws out and its eyes looking up at me wanting food. You see what I mean?
Its eye is off the ball. You've tempted this poor creature.
Right. It then got even worse. What happened was when the chap who owned the dog was coming to work, the minute he opened the door of the newsroom, of the news floor to get in, the programming floor, the dog then bounded out of his hand and went running round to my office. So it had completely lost concentration. And it got so bad, and I feel so terrible about this, that dog had to be retired and sent to a rest home in Scotland.
Well, you could have had the dog if it loved you so much and you were so into giving it chewy bones.
Yeah.
That dog could have come to live with you.
Well, how could I look after a dog when I'm out and work out all day? You know,
that's true. So you should have kept your hands off. You should feel bad about that. I'm sorry to say.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you for the comfort words, Miss Jones. You know, yeah, thank you very much. No, I feel terrible about it. The dog had to be retired, and the chap concerned had to get a new dog. So you know, and they're very expensive to train, these dogs. And the dog concerned went and lived with the chap's dad on a farm in Scotland. So the dog had a lovely rest of his life, you know what I mean? He was bounding around fields in Scotland and all that. But I completely wrecked the discipline of the dog. And then when the second one came, you're absolutely right, I'd learned my lesson. I refused to even acknowledge the dog, you know? I certainly didn't pat it. I didn't call its name. I didn't do anything because I realised I'd made such a mess of it in the first place.
It's a dog's life, though, isn't it, that, being a guide dog? Because it's not much fun. If people can't make a fuss of you and interact with you, really, it's just kind of, God, here we go, cross another bloody road.
Yeah.
That's the size of it, isn't it?
You say that, but actually, you know, a lot of animals like having a purpose in life. And the story I always tell is that, guide dogs apparently do have good lives because they like having, you know, a job and doing what they have to do. And they get a tremendous amount of affection, by the way, from their owners, you know what I mean? Because they are literally a lifeline for them. But the story I always tell is that after 9/11, when the two towers came down, they took all the dogs into the rubble to detect bodies and search for bodies. And despite the fact there were over 3,000 victims, they couldn't find any because they were all either all crushed to pieces or incinerated in the flames. You see what I mean? There was nothing left. Literally, there was nothing left. Mm. And a lot of the dogs had to be put down because they went mad because they weren't succeeding in the job they knew they had to do.
Oh, that's a horrible story.
I know.
Moving swiftly on.
I know. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you know the other thing as well about that, which is very odd?
Oh, do we have to?
Well, you see, Miss Jones,
this is a very sad podcast. People are not getting their usual dose of laughs and frivolity here.
Well, yes, but life is not just a bowl of cherries, as Paul McCartney once said, Miss Jones, and we have to face up to the fact that, you know, horrible things happen in life. I won't tell you my other story now about the Twin Towers, now that you've berated me and don't want to hear it, okay? So we'll move on to the fact that it's also the birthday of old Benny from ABBA. How about that?
Yeah, how old do you think Benny is then?
Well, I think I read he was 66, same age as old Billy Gibbons.
No, he's not. Where are you getting these numbers from?
I don't
know. He's actually 74. He was born the 16th of December, 1946.
Right.
Oh, but he does seem older. He's always seemed rather older to me than his age.
Who? Benny?
Benny. Yeah, there's something a bit kind of ancient about him, like he's been here before.
Really? I didn't realise that, yeah. But I thought for years that Benny and this is the one Bjorn, isn't it?
Bjorn, yeah.
Yeah, Bjorn and Benny. I thought that they were songwriters who they had a little shed at the bottom of Benny's garden, you know, because they lived on this sort of Swedish island, which sounds fantastic, doesn't it? And they'd go in the shed and write all the songs and lyrics and all that. But apparently, Benny wrote all the music and Bjorn wrote all the words.
The lyrics, yeah. They're like Smurfs, aren't they? I suppose it's an obvious thing to say because they're Swedish. Smurfs, you know, like sort of little kind of gnome-type creatures. They look like gnomes, don't they?
No, I don't. They do. I mean, they're Scandinavian people, you know. Honestly, one minute you're telling me, don't you dare say anything about the sisterhood, then you're going around calling two of the most famous singer-songwriters on earth a pair of little Smurfs. Oh, that's very nice, isn't it?
Well, did you know as well that he was an alcoholic for much of his adult life?
He was, Benny.
And he's been teetotal since 2001.
No, I didn't know that. Crikey.
And the other amazing thing, no, I'm not making it up. The other amazing thing, he was engaged to Annifrid Lyngstad, you know, the gorgeous brunette in the band. No, the other one, Annifrid.
Annifrid, yes, sorry, yeah.
They were engaged for 9 years and then they got married in 1978 and got divorced 2 years later.
Yes, I knew all that, yeah, because Benny, of course, was married to Annifrid and Bjorn was married to the world's most beautiful woman, Agnetha, wasn't he?
So, or even Agnetha, yes.
Agnetha, that's right. Yeah, Agnetha, Agnetha, whatever you want to call her. And so that means that all the way, see, you're getting into the giggling mode now, Miss Jones, yeah? So that means that all the way through the success of ABBA, old Benny was an alky.
A boozer. Benny was a boozer, yeah.
Golly, I never saw him looking like he was pissed or anything. But I suppose when you're an alcoholic, you can carry that, can't you?
I suppose maybe because we were pissed all the time as well.
Yeah, that's probably true. Probably true. Yeah, it's hard to tell, isn't it, when you're in a disco at 1 o'clock in the morning, giving it a load of ABBA, that whether the guy singing it is pissed or not. No, yeah. I totally agree. But I mean, they were a world phenomenon, weren't they? You know, we talk
still
about.
Are. I mean, any party that we used to go to in the good old days
before
this year, somebody put the ABBA on, everybody would jump up and start dancing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Ms. Caitlin Moran writes a column in the Times each week.
Do you mean Caitlin Moran?
Is that her? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Caitlin Moron.
No, I don't mean she's a moron. I'm not trying to say that. You know.
I think you did.
No, I didn't. Her name is spelled M-O-R-A-N. As far as I'm concerned, that's pronounced Moran, isn't it? Or Moran or something. What did you say it was?
I think she's Caitlin Moran, yes.
Caitlin Moran, okay, yeah, okay. Yeah. It said this week that the song that, you know, has occupied and preoccupied most of her life is Dancing Queen, because once you've heard it, you can never get it out of your head. And everything she's ever done in life, you know, like her marriage and her first children and all that, was all celebrated by playing Dancing Queen.
Yeah, very much so. It is. It's one of those perennials, isn't it?
It's
everybody
it.
Knows the words.
Yeah.
A bit like Bohemian Rhapsody, I suppose.
Yes, that's right.
We all know the words. We know the melodies. And it's part of the soundtrack of our lives, as
yes,
they say.
I totally agree. Ms. Moran, by the way, Caitlin Moran, yeah. Caitlin Moran, yeah. Caitlin, well. Caitlin. She's a very successful writer, isn't she? She wrote a book.
Yeah, she is.
Was it called How to Be a Girl or something? Or
How to Be a Girl. There was How to Be a Woman. Yeah. I think there's another one since that is all to do with her menopause, but I think we won't go there.
No, I don't think we'll go there, no. And I've met her a couple of times at the BBC studios, you know, when I've been doing something there with Jeremy Vine or something. And
she's quite wild-looking, isn't she?
Oh, yeah, completely wild-looking, yeah. But, you know, great writer. Like the other Miss Jones, like Liz Jones. Now tell me, because I know you're a woman of letters and of terrific knowledge in literature and all this. Have you ever tried to read a John le Carré book?
Of course, yes, of course. I remember reading The Spy Who Came In from the Cold.
Yeah.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah, when you say remember, of course, why did you say of course? Like,
because he's one of the great classics, isn't he? He's part of literature, part of the fabric of being British. One should read those novels.
Well, yes, I agree, except that I couldn't make head nor tail of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. I couldn't understand it. Could you?
I think I could. Yeah,
I think.
No, well, I think I believe that I understood it at the time. I haven't read it for some years. I wonder if I should tackle it again. But there's always so much else to read, isn't there?
Yeah, well, yes, I agree. And The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, I couldn't understand which side the spy was on. So I kind of gave up on them. However, when they then turned them into TV stuff and films and all that, they were very, very entertaining, weren't they?
Mm. Do you know the origin of his name, by the way, his pseudonym?
I may have read it this week because, of course, the reason we're talking about him is he's died. So I might have read it in one of his obituaries, but please remind me.
God rest his soul. Yes. Le Carré is French for the square. And he was kind of known as a bit of a square type, you know, square in terms of how we used to say if somebody was a bit fuddy-duddy.
Yeah.
You'd say they were square. We don't really use that phrase anymore, do we?
But
a pseudonym was needed because the Foreign Office officials were forbidden to publish books in their own names.
And I tell you who had that problem as well, Ian Fleming.
Yes.
Did he have a different name, Ian Fleming, before?
Well, no, he published as Ian Fleming. So
yeah.
He must have left office by then.
Yeah. Oh, yes, he had, I'm sorry. That's right. So you're saying John le Carré was still working for the government?
Yeah, he was working for MI6.
Oh, I see.
And his actual name was David Cornwell.
Cornoil?
Cornwell.
Oh, Cornwell. Sorry, yeah, Cornwell.
And his half-sister was, or is, Charlotte Cornwell, who starred in Rock Follies on television years ago.
Really? What, with Rula Lenska?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rula Lenska, the tumbling ginger hair, married to Dennis Waterman at one point. I met them once.
No, Charlotte Cornwell had the tumbling ginger hair. And really, oh no, I take it back.
Yeah, thank you.
She did. She Excuse did have me. a whole lot of tumbling ginger hair, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I met her and Dennis Waterman at a party once. Well, it wasn't a party; it was like a reception.
Very beautiful woman, wasn't she?
Oh, incredibly good looking. You know, she carried off the role of the Polish countess brilliantly. You know, that's exactly what she was—a deep, husky voice, you know, talking like that and all that. Very, very glamorous. Very good looking.
Who I'm thinking of, the other one, which was Julie Covington.
Julie Covington, that's right. Only Women Bleed, is that Julie Covington?
Yes, exactly. And also, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. She had
Don't
a hit with that.
Cry For Me, Argentina. Yeah, I love
we'll
that.
Let you know.
Yeah, thank you. Wasn't that also sung by Tim Rice's diminutive girlfriend?
Elaine Page, yes.
She sung that
so
as well.
Julie had the hit with it originally.
That's right, she did.
And then they invited her to play Evita, I think, in the stage production.
Yeah.
And she turned it down because she was very low-key and quite private.
Oh, yeah.
Which, considering that, it was a bit of a dodgy career to choose being an actress, wasn't it?
But, sorry, are you talking about Julie Covington now?
Yes, yes.
Oh, she was offered she was just a singer. I thought she was just a singer.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that was the reason. But Elaine Page obviously took it to great glory.
Yeah.
And then Madonna sang it in the film version.
Yeah, Madonna, I can't remember who made the film. It wasn't Lord Lloyd Webber, was it?
Yeah, it was Alan Parker.
Alan Parker, okay, that's right.
The late, great Alan Parker, yes.
That's right. And I remember reading that Madonna, I mean, literally flew across the Atlantic Ocean 3 times to make sure she got the part, banging on his door and, you know, going to his house and his home, the part's for me. But in the end, it was a bit of a flop, wasn't it?
It wasn't the biggest hit, was it? It's a shame because the stage production was so glorious. And I felt sorry for Elaine Page because they'd been in discussion about the film for many, many years, during which time Elaine basically grew too old to play Evita.
Really?
Evita was a young woman, wasn't she?
And,
and I felt sorry for her because I felt that it was her role. She'd made that part.
Yeah.
And had they made the film sooner, Elaine could have starred in it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one of those tragedies of life, I'm afraid. As Mick Jagger once said, what a drag it is getting old. I'm very musical this morning, aren't I?
Yeah, what's happened to you? What have you been sucking this morning?
No, I haven't been sucking anything. Do you mind? This is a family show. I can't say things like that at breakfast.
I meant lozenges or something, isn't it?
Oh, dear me.
Goodness sake, you do have a filthy mind.
Yeah. Now, listen, what do you think about this? This is a really, really strange story, and you will have seen it. A roofer who crossed the Irish Sea on a jet ski to visit his girlfriend has been jailed for 4 weeks for putting the population of the Isle of Man at risk from COVID-19, where there is not one single case. But have you read the
I feel very sorry for this guy, Dale McLaughlin.
Yeah.
He's a roofer from Scotland, and he was missing his chick. So he gets on a jet ski. He's never driven one before in his life.
Never.
He thinks it's going to take him about 40 minutes to get across to the Isle of Man. It took about 4 hours. Now he's in prison for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But the thing I want to know is, was he tested and was he infectious? And if so, what's he doing in a prison?
Well, you know, I think the whole idea is that he landed on the Isle of Man without a certificate to say he didn't have COVID-19. Therefore, he broke all the rules. It doesn't matter whether he's got the infection or not.
Yeah. But it's such a romantic story, isn't it? Well, you know, imagine somebody would go to those lengths and see it.
I think he's a bit disturbed, to be honest. I think anybody who gets on, I mean, you've got, no, listen, the Irish Sea is one of the roughest and choppiest seas in the world, literally, because it runs between what's a kind of narrow channel between Ireland, and the Great Britain mainland. But what I don't understand is, how on earth did he make it? I mean, can you imagine burning across the Irish Sea with waves 6 feet high? Heading and how, this is the other thing I couldn't work out, is how did he know where the Isle of Man was?
Because I know,
you know,
with no navigation equipment or anything like that.
Exactly.
It's a wonderful story. It's kind of one of those little stories that somebody will pick up and make a whole film about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, good God, I mean, I like adventure and all that, but how the boy didn't drown. When he got there, the coast guards looked at the jet ski gone on. He had 4 minutes of fuel left. So it was incredible timing, incredible navigation, because the Isle of Man's a little island in the middle of the Irish Sea. How did he actually find it? You know, I don't know whether I can believe the story. It's one of those sort of things, you know.
It's almost an April Fool. If this were a different time of year, we'd be asking that question, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we certainly would. I totally agree. Now, talking about this time of year, Miss Jones, will you actually be able to get to your beloved St. Bride's on Christmas Day or sometime around there, Christmas Eve or something like that, for a carol service?
We have booked in. We have to book now because spaces are limited because of social distancing for COVID. So we've booked in for the first time in a few years to go to Midnight Communion on Christmas Eve.
Oh, brilliant.
So we will be there on Christmas morning, but in the very early hours. We usually would rock up on Christmas morning itself.
Yeah, okay. And does that mean you can stand in the church like 2 metres away from other people?
Yeah. As a family group, so there are four of us. I have three children, adult children. So the four of us can sit together, but we then have to sit distanced from people of other households.
Well, that'll be beautiful, won't it? You know, in the early hours of Christmas Day, all the lights on and the tree up in the church and all that. And, of course, your friend, the Reverend, Alison?
Yes. Yes, she'll be conducting the service, the Reverend Canon Dr. Alison Joyce.
Yeah.
And... it's something to rejoice for, simply being there, because
we
haven't been able to be there very much this year.
No, in a year like this year. The reason I mention it is because I was looking at sort of not religious services, but, you know, where you can go if you want to. I used to go to the midnight service in Chester Cathedral, you see, when I was a youth. I mean, we're all pissed, obviously. We're working on the Chester Chronicle. Yeah, seriously. And you went out and got completely bladdered on Christmas Eve. But then there was always a midnight service, carol service. So we'd all go along. And it was like being in a football crowd, really. You know, it was great.
Oh, yeah. I can just imagine all of you, Lord,
stinking
away at the back.
Well, you know, it was Christmas Eve and we were paying our respects to little baby Jesus. And so anyway, I'm looking through what's on offer. And it says here, Chester's finest. This historic former monastery is embracing the Christmas relaxation of rules with gusto. Tickets are available for the daily family Christmas tree festival at £2.50, plus various concerts, recitals and services. There's even a chance to visit Santa in the cathedral refectory. Sorry, I was going to say refectory.
Yeah, the refectory. Yes. Yeah.
But I'm a friend of Chester Cathedral. And I tell you how I became that. On a visit to the cathedral just a few years ago, maybe about 5-6 years ago, visit to Chester. I'd often go up to Chester and stay in the Grosvenor Hotel and then go over to Liverpool to watch my team, Everton, you know. But I love I love Chester for the city walls and the Grosvenor Hotel. So I must have been walking past the cathedral when I decided to go in. And, of course, I'd been drinking all day with some old friends, you know. And this seems to happen rather often to me, doesn't it, actually?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. And And about a week later, I got this huge package from Chester, and I'd apparently signed up as a friend of Chester Cathedral, lifelong, you know, with a huge subscription fee each year, which I'm very happy to do, because I love cathedrals. I have no idea. I just cannot work out how cathedrals got built in the Middle Ages, when there was no electricity, no hydraulics, you know, very little.
No technology. It is extraordinary, an amazing feat. I've often thought that, especially going into one of the huge French cathedrals like Notre Dame, for example. You know, how did they make those things? They took hundreds of years to build.
Yes. But, I mean, even things like drawing a straight line on a brick or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Things as basic as that. It's just, it defies belief. And how did they get the gargoyles up to the top and then put them in position, all that kind of stuff?
How did they carve them in the first place? But then I've had the same kind of feelings when I visited the pyramids in Egypt or Stonehenge. You know, it defies anything that we can achieve today.
I agree.
Because we have everything to help us.
I agree. It's just utterly remarkable. Chester is a particularly beautiful cathedral because it, as I just explained in that description, it used to be a monastery. So it's got cloisters, you know, it's got a square of cloisters. And the school I went to was the King's School Chester, but that was on their new site, which had only been there for about 10 years when I first went there. Before that, it had been in the bowels of Chester Cathedral, and the cloisters were the classrooms.
Mm. That would Salisbury Cathedral has cloisters like that as well. It is. I love. There's something about a cloister, isn't there?
Yes.
Actually, there are cloisters at my son's old school, Dulwich College.
Oh right, okay.
And it's all a bit Harry Potter, you know. It just feels kind of medieval and comforting in some way.
Totally agree. Right. Okay, Ms. Jones, that's it from us today. So I want to say I hope that you have a beautific next couple of days before we meet again.
Beautific. Lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
What I mean? I couldn't think of another word then, actually, to be honest.
Beautific is my word of the day.
I shall go forth and
use that word as frequently as I can.
Yeah, limited vocabulary, I'm afraid. Right. So to all people listening, just to remind everybody, if you don't mind, that you will find me on the radio this weekend on Talk Radio at 5 o'clock on Saturday and 1 o'clock on Sunday. Ms. Jones, I know now that you're off going doing some filming or broadcasting in your very, very busy life. So I wish you the best of luck for your day, and we'll talk again soon.
We will.
I read in one of the books, he used to take real joy in ringing up his mum and dad on a Friday night when he'd started his pop career in London, you know, and they were becoming famous. And just to shock his parents, because they were so matronly and his dad was a vicar, he used to tell his parents how many women he'd caught venereal disease off that week, you know, and he'd said, oh, I've got gonorrhea and all this sort of stuff.
Well, so you can actually count how many you get it from. That's unusual.
Well,
is that a scientific development?
Well, I don't know. And I'm sorry, this is a family show, obviously, but I mean, it just...
You've just remembered.
I've just remembered it's a family show, so we should scrub that from the record, really.
Yeah, go on then. Off. Yeah, how old do you think Benny is then?
Well, I think I read he was 66, the same age as old Billy Gibbons.
No, he's not. Where are you getting these numbers from?
I don't know.
Actually 74. He was born the 16th of December 1946.
Right.
But he does seem older. He's always seemed rather older to me than his age.
Who? Benny?
Benny. Yeah, there's something a bit kind of ancient about him, like he's been here before.
Really? I didn't realise that, yeah. What a drag it is getting old. I'm very musical this morning, aren't I?
Yeah, what's happened to you? What have you been sucking this morning?
No, I haven't been sucking anything. Do you mind? This is a family show. Can't say things like that at breakfast.
I meant lozenges or something, isn't it?
Oh, dear me.
Goodness, you do have a filthy mind.
Yeah.